I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's hot. I don't do well in the heat. Do you fare better in cold or hot weather?
I don't mind heat. I feel like, you know, I went for, you know, my first 30 years without ever having air conditioning and like,
yes.
And then, you know, started shacking up with women that had air conditioning and like,
that was the plan, man. That was the plan.
Yeah, but I feel back in the day, I mean, maybe it's because I was younger, but I feel like also like I just like, I acclimated. Like, I feel like now we don't acclimate to summer, you know? Like, I feel like, yeah, I used to acclimate. Like, the first couple hot days would be horrible, but then, like, you'd kind of acclimate to it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I lived without air conditioning for most of my life.
Yeah.
I mean, and I hated it every time I didn't have it. You know, it was funny. It was, I grew up with, like, one AC in the house. It was in my brother's room. And if it was a really, really hot night, everyone had to go sleep in my brother's room.
Oh, my God.
And that was the deal. And then we moved into another house with no AC. And then, you know, long story, but my family splits up. And now I'm in this two-bedroom apartment with my mom that just got built. It's in one of these, like, apartment complexes that just got built. Fuck, man. You put the AC on that place, 68 degrees in about 4 minutes, and it cost about $14 to do for like the whole month.
Right.
The model of efficiency. I'm not saying I want to move my family into a low income two bedroom apartment where, you know, where I grew up, but the AC was fucking nice, I'll tell you that much.
Yeah, when you need it. I mean, there's times when you need it for sure. It's really, but you know, it's the fucking humidity, dude. I mean, if I were going to build my dream house, that it would be central dehumidifying and then ceiling fans.
Wow.
I don't like it when it's too cold. I don't like it. You know, I could never understand people who keep their houses colder in the summer than they do in the winter. Like, that just doesn't make sense.
Like, what it's the relief. It's the sweet relief. It's like when you come out and you just walk into it and you're like, oh, it's so nice.
Yeah, it's great at first and then you get cold.
So why don't you explain to people who can't see what you're looking at right now?
I'm looking at shirtless Benny sweating in his bedroom.
You like what you see?
Wait, I'm actually live streaming this. This is for the patrons.
I don't care. There's a lot of people who see me without my shirt off. I used to have the confidence. Like, I really do enjoy playing drums without a shirt on. Like, it's nice. It feels good. It frees me up. But there's been only a couple times in my life and career that I've had, like, the confidence and feeling good enough about myself to have a shirtless period. And usually something really messes it up. And I was just feeling good about myself, like, a couple years ago. And I'm doing research for a book. For that Gaslight, the re-release we did, the 59 Sound book. And I'm on Getty Images looking at images of the band, you know, like 90% of them are Brian. And then I get to like one little section that's me. Oh, my God. It's these shots from like one of the worst shows we ever played. It was like, I think it was the first show on the American Slang Touring when we played Bonnaroo, you know, the one down in Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't in tour shape yet. It was very hot. I didn't have my stuff ready. So I go ahead and I just rip my shirt off and play Bonnaroo without a shirt. The only images on Getty Images of me that you can purchase for your own pleasure are like these side fucking like spare tire shots with like my stomach just hanging over my jeans playing drums like the biggest muffin top. It's like they were shooting the muffin top, not me, you know. And it's just like,
and that's your legacy on Getty Images.
Yeah. And I imagine like the actual experience happening and me flopping around, probably not looking so good up there. And that fucked me up for like probably another 5 years, unless I get my old man Iggy Pop body. That's what I'm going for now. I don't want to be jacked. I want whatever the fuck Iggy Pop's got going on, where he's like obviously in great shape, but his skin's kind of just hanging off, you know?
Well, he's like, old, man.
I know, but he looks great.
Yeah, he looks amazing for his age.
So,
I mean, yeah.
Yeah. So that's been my history. I even joke around like anytime we've done TV stuff. Like, you know, when you do those late night shows, there's always like drummer cam like back there. Right. The guy's like back there.
Right.
And I always fuck around with that guy. I'm like, yo, do me a favor. keep it breast up, okay? Let's keep these let's keep these mud flaps out of the shot. Do me a favor. I don't need these flapping around on fucking Jimmy Kimmel or whatever's happening, you know?
Man, you're in good shape, buddy.
Good enough.
Yeah,
I've never been able to go over the hump. You know, I've learned about myself too. Is like I need inspiration to get in shape. Like I don't have the self will to just like wake up every day and be positive and forward enough that I'm like, I'm gonna eat right, I'm gonna treat my body right, and I'm gonna do this because it's the best thing to do. Like more often than not, I'm gonna slip into some sort of dark hole. And before I know it, I'm having a sandwich, fucking up some grilled cheese for lunch, not feeling so good about myself, some scotch for dinner, you know, and like before I know it, I'm not doing so well. The only thing that like gets me motivated to get into shape is if I have shows or tours.
Right.
Literally. It's the only thing. So I guess the only way you can get me into shape is if it's for like a job. So.
Yeah, this is not a good time for diets right now. I'll tell you.
No. I was doing, you know. The paranoid side of me was doing really well at first because all the inactivity I had was met with like a fear of getting food. So
right.
I was doing no overeating whatsoever. Actually, quite the opposite. I was like, I'm not eating that because I want the kids to have that tomorrow and I don't feel like going to the store again for like 3 more weeks because it's terrifying, you know?
Right.
So at first, when things were really scary as far as like, what's going to happen to our supply? Is the distribution chain going to be messed up? Like, you know, I really thought that was possible. So that was keeping me slim at first. And then when I realized my fat ass could get whatever I want, whenever I want, basically, if I'm wearing a mask, and then I wasn't playing drums and then I wasn't working out. Yeah. Now it's gotten bad. I look like shit now.
Well, at least we eat healthier. I mean, when you eat at home, right? I mean, I do.
Yes, I have to. I'm on lockdown at home. You know, like, you know, we don't let certain things into the house.
Right. Yeah. You've got,
I could go ahead and sneak some Taco Bell, but that shit's not coming through the front door. Yeah.
But I definitely drink every night, which wasn't doing before.
Pandemic. You do.
Yeah. Not a lot. Like two beers, sometimes
you do
three,
a beer,
but no more, never more than like three.
You beer, never do
wine.
A,
I do wine or sometimes
wine.
A cocktail. I'm one of those, I'm very like, I'm very easily influenced. Like if I'm watching a movie and they pour a shot of whiskey, I go straight to the cabinet.
Yeah, it's hard.
I always try to have a couple nice, nice single malts and whatever in there.
Yeah, what's that drink Don Draper would drink on Mad Men? He had a drink.
I can't remember.
It was an old fashioned maybe.
Oh yeah, it sounds like a really
And I remember
60s.
Being like, man, I got to try one of these, an old fashioned. I ordered it. It was disgusting.
It's like sugar. It's like mashed sugar and fruit, right? Like a
terrible.
Cherry mashed up. Yeah,
terrible.
It's pretty bad.
I don't know how they say it. It was like the White Claw of the 1950s. So anyway, speaking of White Claw, that would be a good nickname for Matt if he didn't, yeah, like if that drink didn't didn't take off. I could see the White Claw being a real good nickname for him. Yeah, maybe I'll appropriate it the right way since that stuff sucks. But I've been a big fan of the Bronx from like the get of the Bronx. Like literally, you know, as he was talking about in the interview that you'll get to, ironically, you know, they you know, rose to prominence really fast, and out of nowhere there was this like band name that was fucking everywhere, and they had that great cover art with the, you know, bleeding fangs on the first record, and it was just like, what is this? And, you know, luckily for me, they were on this trajectory, but, you know, my friend's label was the one that was putting out their first album, and they were like deeply connected to my situation. So I got to see and hang out with the Bronx a lot early on, and I was never disappointed. You know, every time I heard them, every time I saw them, every time I hung out with them, I was like, I fucking love this band. Even to the point I'm wearing a Bronx hat on the cover of the biggest album I ever did, you know?
Right.
So I, you know, I'm a huge fan of the band, and I was so happy to have him on. And Matt is like a really dynamic character, you know, like if you saw him on stage, be like, oh, this is like maybe like a scary punk rock guy. And he's just like really sweet, really positive, down for a party. And he's a real punk rocker for sure. But definitely not like, you don't get like a Sid Vicious vibe from him. You know what I mean? Like,
he's a wholesome punk.
He's a nice guy. He's just a nice guy. You know, he's easy to talk to, talk Lakers with him, talk Dodgers, talk music. And he's just a lot of fun to be around. So
yeah,
I was really glad that, that we were able to make this happen, and he came on.
Let's check it out.
Yeah, long interview. Let's get into it.
It's going on track!
Hey, Matt. You just caught us in the middle of... So Brad, you know, lives in New York City.
Yeah.
And decided to make the venture to the Jersey Shore last weekend.
Oh.
Without consulting his boy here.
Really?
He went to like the real like trashy bay part of the ocean where like it was, you know, it's where like the NASCAR fans like take off their coats and take a dip, you know? He didn't realize.
Yeah.
He should have called his boy.
It's like an oil slick.
Yeah, it was pretty bad.
It's like the beaches there aren't even soft. Like the sand even hurts there, you know?
Yeah. That's like Santa Monica over here. If you go to like Santa Monica, like everything around like the pier where like the, you know, the roller coaster and kind of all that like kind of famous stuff is, it's just like you can't even swim in that water. Like Venice is still kind of clean, but
yeah,
like Santa Monica is usually just, it just looks like a big oil slick through there. It's just,
really,
it's disgusting. Yeah.
See, and I imagine it as like,
well, you just think it's like all just like, it's like corn dog water, you know what I mean? It's just like all, like, I always just imagine just like all the greasy stuff from the pier and just like trash and just, I don't know. I just, no thank you, you know?
I mean, what kind of area, is it like the type of area where people feel the liberty to like, you know, oh, I'm going to eat street food and like eat half of it and throw the rest into the water and shit. Like, yeah, like that.
I mean, I think so. I've been there on numerous occasions. Okay. Numerous occasions where literally the water's been like, you blocked off, like you can't go swim.
Oh,
like you can't. Yeah.
Like so, environmentally like, restricted.
Yeah. And it's literally like, from what I've seen, it's literally just around that area. Cause you know, Malibu's historic, you know, obviously. Sure, and, you know, the water up there is good to go. And, you know, I don't know enough about the Venice water to speak on it, but I know it has some issues in the past, you know, and then it's like, you know, that's the thing about the LA beaches are tricky, man, because it's so expensive to live there, but some of the water is suspect, man. It's that's the kind of thing about Orange County that if you surf or if you're a fan of the beach, as far as like, you know, the ocean itself, it's just a little bit cleaner down here, you know, which goes a long way when you do a lot of swimming or you enjoy the ocean. You know, you don't want to be running into needles or corn dogs.
What's your spot? Like, what's your go-to spot? Or are you allowed to say, can you not blow it up on the air?
No. I live in Huntington Beach, so I mean, okay. It's right here, down here right now. It is. I mean, it is. You are living in, you know, in a comic book, pretty much. It's like, it's crazy. I mean, the climate down here between politics and pandemics and summertime and all that stuff, it's just, it's completely insane. But the water's clean.
There's that. Yeah. So it's not just Revelation Records anymore, huh?
No. Yeah. I mean, you know, there's always been a you know, there's a lot of history down here, yeah. You know, good and bad, you sure. know, but it's an interesting place to live for sure. You know, I grew up in Los Angeles, like kind of outskirts of East LA, a city called Pico Rivera.
Okay.
And obviously, you know, spent a lot of time in Los Angeles, you know, as, you know, the Bronx and Mariachi Bronx kind of, you know, took off and started. And, you know, I grew up and lived there, lived in the Valley, all that stuff. And I kind of moved down this way about, I don't know, about 15 years ago, something like that, just to kind of get away from everything. And, I love the beach, the city itself, you know, it's a cool place to live. If you have like, you know, if you got a brain, you can think for yourself, you know, it's like a lot of people think a lot of different things about it. And most of them are true. But for me, actually living here, I can navigate it, you know, so it's all good.
Is it like when you grow up in LA, is it like, you know, cause like in my head, like if you're like a born and bred New Yorker, and you got to make the move out to like Jersey or Long Island or something, there's kind of like a swallowing of pride. Like the coolest thing and the most respect thing is to, you know, like live and die miserably inside of the city. Is there like the same thing in LA? Like when you start going out to the outskirts or Orange County, people are like, psh, you should.
Oh, I mean, yeah, for sure. I mean, the beef is real, you know? I mean, it's like, you know, I mean, LA is definitely, you know, got the culture and the coolness, you know, but it's just, you know, California in general. I mean, it's tough. Cause I mean, if I wasn't from here, if I wasn't, you know, born and raised here, I probably would have left a long time ago, you know, cause it's so expensive and it's getting to a point where it's completely like overthought, you know? So it's like, you know, it's just hard to like find any sort of like, you know, simplicity sometimes, or just like, you know, any sort of like, you know, like you find yourself kind of like, you never want to be that guy that's like, fuck, I wish we could go back a little bit, you know, or, you know, but it's like, it's just a little, it's a little crazy, you know, it's like,
yeah. What
it's
do you mean by a hard
place to, it's a hard place to get comfortable, you know, but it's like, for me, it's like, I can't really ever see myself leaving, you know, just because it's like, I mean, I love it, you know, but it's like, you know, between Los Angeles, Orange County, you know, San Diego, San Francisco, you know, there's so much, you know, there's so much diversity and culture and awesome people, you know, so
for sure.
If you can kind of find a way to skate around, you know, the bullshit, which is kind of why I came down here, you know, and it's like, if you can kind of find a way to get around that, and find yourself like a little spot that's not, you know, $4,000 a month or something like that, then you'll probably be stoked.
You know, it's something about the California thing. It doesn't even matter where you go, you know, like, so I'm hanging out with Hammer from Violent Gentlemen. I don't know if you know this great clothing company out of Orange County.
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, and, you know, he was nice enough to put me up at his place and put my band up at his place last time we were there. And, you know, we're having a conversation outside. I'm explaining to him, you know, the trouble I have with sleep because, you know, I'm a New Yorker and neurotic and paranoid. And, like we all need to do something weird to sleep. It's just, like, part of the nature here. And he's just like, yeah, you know, like, I just go to bed. You know, I usually like just put my head in the pillow, pass out and wake up about 10 hours later. I'm like, what? That's it? You know, and I'm like, wait a minute. Are you born and raised in Orange County? Like, have you never lived anywhere else? He's like, nope. And I started doing like some field research almost and just people I know. And there is honestly, there's just this like there's something, there's just an ease to the mind. There's something about waking up in California every day for your entire life that just like does something differently to your spirit than growing up on the East Coast, man. It's definitely.
Oh, I mean, 100%. I mean, I remember the, you know, the first time I went to the East Coast, I remember waking up in New York for the first time and, you know, stumbling out around 9 a.m. or something like that. And just the, you know, this city almost swallowed me whole. You know, my first two steps on the sidewalk, I couldn't believe how fast people were moving, how loud everything was. You know, I'm just like, you know, where's my avocados, you know? So it's just like, I mean, and I fell in love with it instantly, you know, right, like right. I was just like, whoa, because, you know, I was just like, I can't, this is, it's so cool to experience like both coasts, you know. Sure. It's like, it's something that, you know, if you haven't, it's like, it's unreal. It's so cool. What makes them so different. And it's so rad and so true how, you know, East Coasters just, you know, they just get after it and they just go for it and they're just fucking moving nonstop, you know? And it's like the West Coast is the exact opposite. You know, it's like, right. we get our stuff done, but it's laid back, you know, yeah. It's laid back and it's slow and it's, sure. it's got a whole different style, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it was really cool to be able to experience that. And I really do. I love it and I appreciate it, you know? And then you have, you know, and then you get weirder, you know, as you go into the middle. I mean, you throw that Texas lifestyle in there. I don't even know what that is, you know.
After all these years, I think Texas is more like us. You know, they're kind of aggressive. They drive fast. They sort of have this, like, irrational pride about where they're from, that it's, like, the greatest place in the world and nowhere else is good.
Very true.
You know, especially like the cities in Texas, like I'm driving around and I'm like, this feels like strangely familiar to me. These people are just kind of unnecessarily angry and aggressive, you know,
yeah.
which does feel familiar. But then, like you said, you know, if you hit, you know, Texas at the East or West Coast and you see that, oh, you're like, oh, I have 900 miles to get through this fucking thing. You know, you drive through like a lot of, you know, all of a sudden you're in something that feels like Oklahoma, then you're in something that feels like Arizona, you know, it's that's just a, who knows, we could, and it's basically Mexico anyway, you know?
Yeah, it's, I mean, I love Texas, man, I love it, like, I was thinking, like, where can I live if I did, you know, leave California, and I could definitely do Texas. I could.
Where about, you think?
I mean, you know, I mean, Austin's automatic, you know, but Austin's so insane. It's like, sure. At this point, it's like, you know, 10 cities in one. But it's like, it's still such a rad place and such a cool place for artists and musicians. I could do Dallas, you know, I love Dallas. I think Dallas has come a long way. It's got a lot more kind of culture and art to it now.
Sure.
You know, it's like, and, you know, I couldn't do Houston because Houston, the weather's just too crazy. You know, it's just like, it's too nuts. It literally changes every 10 minutes or whatever, you know. So, but, I mean, I could also, you know, I could be one of those dudes that just, you know, has, you know, like a 83 Ford truck and just has some, you know, weird, like, just, you know, shack in the middle of nowhere and just kind of, you know, as long as I can... It's like if I can get some sort of electricity, you know, a refrigerator, Wi-Fi signal, I'll be fine. I could do that Texas life, man. I don't mind it.
Ranch. So are you like when you get home from tour and you're not working and stuff, like are you kind of a homebody? Do you like being at home?
I mean, I appreciate being at home. I'm not really like a hermit or anything like that. I mean, I love being able to get home and unwind and like, you know, like kind of like unpack mentally, you know, for sure. But I like living life, man. You know, I like going out and doing stuff and, you know, driving places and, you know, experiencing things and talking to people and kind of, you know, and just doing that. I mean, I appreciate being at home, but, you know, I don't need to do it too often.
Sure. Well, I mean, that being said, you know, how's your mind been and how's your productivity been during the quarantine, like where exactly are you at and how you've been keeping yourself and your mind occupied during this time?
It's crazy, man. I mean, it changes day to day, you know. Right. It's like overall it's been pretty good, you know. You got to keep, like, you know, I guess a higher perspective is what I try to maintain, you know. It's like I'm still alive, I'm, you know, still healthy, and you know, I'm living by the beach, and I may not be playing music right now, but I play music for a living, and, you know, I'm doing my thing. So, you know, it's like, all in all, it's like, you know, everything is still, you know, positive, you know, but it's like, it's definitely, yeah, the grand scale, but, you know, it's like, then you start, I mean, this is the most, I mean, dude, I mean, you know, it's like Bronx tours nonstop. So it's like, this is literally the longest I've been home in 15 years.
Right. Yeah.
You know, so it's like, and it, once that kind of hits you, then you're kind of like, whoa, that's kind of fucked up. And then you're like, and then you start playing that mental game where you just go down these rabbit holes. Like the other day, I was just like, it's so like, it's such a trip to, like, you know, 'cause so much of who I am is like based on what I do. So it's like, 'cause I mean, music is my life, you know? So it's like, and it's like, so then it's like, well, like if I'm not like doing, then it's like, wait a minute, who am I? And then you're just like, oh, you know, and then you're just like, you realize you're just like staring off into the distance at like a, you know, in like a supermarket or something. So you're just like,
what is this? Yeah. I mean, I saw that piece you wrote for knotfest.com and I saw a part in it that almost was kind of giving off the feeling that not only like, who am I? But like, what have I been doing this whole time? And is there value in spending my entire life like making music and things like that? Have you reconciled that at all? Because when you wrote that piece, you seem pretty bummed out about it.
No, yeah, I mean, it was funny about that thing. So I wrote that. They're like, hey, you want to write something for the Knotfest? I was like, okay. So, you know, I write this thing, and it's like, I wrote it in the morning, and I was like, holy shit, this is kind of dark. it's kind of dark, you know?
Well, it's a metal website, right?
I learned a while ago that it's like, you know, you have to take a moment before you put stuff out there, because it's going to be out there forever.
Right.
You know what I mean? And it's like, you got to realize, like, do you want, like, this may be how you feel, but do you want to show that to people? You know, do you want people to know that, you know? So, I initially sent it to our manager, Josh, and I was like, he's like, wow, man, this is kind of heavy. I was like, I don't know, you know, and it's like 5 minutes after I sent him, I was like, dude, I was like, let's just scrap this. It doesn't feel right. And then, so he's like, okay. And then, you know, like a week later, he got back to me. He's like, hey, Knotfest, you know, they really want to run that thing. They're really into it. They like it. It's like, you know, it's like just kind of a raw thing, and they were into it. So I reread it and I fixed a couple things. I was like, all right.
So. Yeah.
I mean, it is what it is, you know.
I mean, real. It's real, and I think for any musician reading it, I don't, you know, I'd say 99% of musicians at some point along the point of doing this, and probably often, especially if I'm talking about myself, have to reconcile that feeling, you know, like is this important? Is this doing anything? And when there's something real happening in the world and something that involves, you know, action or money or things that you can do to help, and you're like, oh, I just made a record with my friends. Like, did that do anything to help the world?
Yeah, it's hard to balance like the like, you know, the greater good with like, you know, your own life. You know, it's like, that's like it's a hard thing to kind of figure out right now for a lot of people. You know, not just musicians. You know, but it's like, and that's kind of the thing. It's like, and when I was sitting with that article, I was like, well, do I want to try to, like, you know, 'cause I'm a positive guy, you know? So it's like, I was like, do I want to try to like rewrite this ending to kind of make like a positive statement? And I was like, nah, fuck it. You know, it's like, it is what it is.
It's real.
So, but yeah, it's like, I 100% like believe in what I'm doing, what we're doing, what musicians do, what artists do, and all this stuff during this crazy time. It's just so weird. There's so many, honestly, there's just so many like just insane conversations that take place in my head on a daily basis of just like, and just like trying to like figure out, like trying to understand everything that's happening right now. And just like where it's going, like what it all means. And it's just like, it's a super crazy time, dude. I mean, it's like, I was, you know, looking back and kind of reflecting on stuff, and it's like, it's a trip to say, but it's like, you know, I'm 41 years old, and it's like, this is most definitely, without a doubt, like the craziest time since I've been alive. Like, in my lifetime, this is this is the fucking weirdest the world's been. You know what I mean? It's like
100%. Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like you look at like, you know, it was 68 or whatever when it's like you had like the second Kennedy got shot, Martin Luther King, and you know, you had like all like crazy civil rights at the end of Vietnam and all that stuff. Like that must have been insane.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But it's like this, you know, this is like, this is just, it's just next level, man. And it's like, I don't know where, and like where's it going? You know, that's the thing that I think a lot of people struggle with. And that's the hardest thing, I think, is you want to be able to grab onto something. You want to be able to throw an anchor somewhere, and you just can't. It's like you just can't, and it's like, and so it's like, you know, if you have, you know, a lot of artists, they got issues, man. It's like me, I can get manic from time to time. So it's like when my brain starts going, and it's just like you just want to be able to like, you know, you, and that's the thing too. It's crazy how sometimes, at least for me, in these type of times, and I think for a lot of people, from friends I've been talking to. It's hard to create, like it's hard to focus on one thing. Honestly, it's hard to sit down and be like, okay, like I'm gonna write a song, or I'm gonna do this, or I'm gonna do that. Like I had super crazy like moments last week of just like extreme inspiration where I like wrote and then I like, you know, recorded and did all these things, and like. And it felt so good to finally feel that, because it's like I was trying to like make it come out of me, because I was like, God, everything around me sucks. I just want to do something fun, you know? And it's like, I just couldn't do it. It was just like, God, it's just like, I don't know how you've been during this thing, but it's like, I've had, you know, it's like, I'm pretty normal on like a, you know, I'm riding like a 5 or 6 out of 10 on a daily basis, like, dude, there was like, like a month ago or something, dude, I had like a week and a half, two weeks straight, dude, where I was just like, dude, I was doing nothing.
Yeah.
Like, and I was just like, dude, this sucks. I couldn't get out, dude. I couldn't do anything if I tried, dude. I was like, I just could not do it. And it was just like, God damn, this is brutal, you know? But it's like, you know, but then it's like, that's when you jump back into perspective and you're like, okay, like, fuck, you know, like I'm sitting here, you know, creatively, you know, just mute, you know, and it's just like, but you know, it's like, I'm still, you know, it's like, I'm not George Floyd, you know, I'm not fucking dead, you know, I'm not this, I'm not that. And it's like, so you find, you know, you find ways to like, to, you know, to battle through it. And, you know, you realize that there's bigger things happening around you than you go, but it's like, it's almost like the bigger picture is like a day job now. And so it's like, you wake up and you have all these things that you can be a part of, and you can get online and you can read all these things, and you can be an activist for all these people that don't have voices, and you can do that. And then it's like, you know, then you come home from work and you hang your jacket up and you're just like,
what now? Well, yeah, I mean, it's such a strange thing to reconcile too, because, you know, often when, you know, you're not feeling inspired to be creative, you can find a lot of things in like real life that are like, oh, this is the reason I can't create right now. This is the reason I'm not inspired. And when you're literally like being told to be home, told to do nothing, and almost told to have that time in your head, you know, there's like no sensible reason why you shouldn't be creating constantly, because I have the time that I've been asking for forever to just sit here and work and create. But, you know, early on in this, I tried to, you know, realize like during the whole time that like this is unprecedented, you know, and like any way I react or anything that happens on a day-to-day basis is fine. Because, like, there's no roadmap for this. You know what I mean? There's no one who's coming out of it being like, you know what? During the digital age, this is the finest way to create in a pandemic. You know, like, we're paving the road. So it's like, you know, I think maybe it does favor the people who were grinders. And I'm not sure what you are. You know, like, I think the people who need to set up situations for themselves to truly be inspired and create in this like exact way they need to are probably suffering more than the people who are grinders. You know, the people who sit down every day at their computer or their guitar and they like make sure they get something out and make sure they create something. You know, those people, you know, like the Kurt Vonnegut school of creation, like it doesn't matter what you put down every day that you're supposed to be improving your craft every day. So, you know, I think the grinders are doing fine, but I think the people who really need, and like you said, you know, most of the people who do this are, and you know, they're crazier than you or I, like I know that, like most of the people are way more impacted emotionally from the things around them and need a certain scenario in order to create the right way, you know? So it is, it's totally unprecedented. And I think if you have a couple weeks where, you know, you're not getting anything worthwhile down, like, it's all right, man. You know, like it's cool. You should be easy on yourself.
No, yeah. I mean, you gotta be, you know, you gotta be easy on yourself. You know, it's unprecedented. It's a wild ride, like mentally, man. And it's like, yeah. You know, it's like, and it's not even necessarily, you know, I mean, obviously, it's a big part of that is you know, artistically and creatively, but just outside of it, just like, you know, like the weight of the world and what's happening and where it's all going is just like, I mean, it's just insane, you know. I mean, but it's like,
yeah,
well, we'll see what happens. I mean, who knows, man?
Well, I mean, think that a lot of people are questioning their value in these times. You know, that's and like the fact that you can't just sit down and make art, but just because you have the time, that could be really. But the truth is like, this is why you see people on, you know, you see your friends on Facebook getting intense joy out of fucking cleaning the house, or you know what I mean? Because it's just like, it gives you a little bit of value, and it's also a simple like act that kind of harkens back to normal times. I mean,
yeah,
I was like, I went upstate a couple of weeks ago and helped another dad build a treehouse, and I swear to God, it was the most satisfying thing I may have ever done in my life.
That's, you know, awesome, man.
At our age, right? Like, we're, you know, I'm nearly 40. You know, Brad's collecting Social Security. you know, at this point, like, I'm like, we made our decisions. You know what I mean? Like, none of us are getting gold watches. None of us are company men. None of us are career activists. So I try to think of myself in this as like one of those like string players who goes down with the Titanic. You know, it's like this is what we do. And we're just going to play it out until the end, because this is what I am, you know. And I'm sure there's plenty of people listening to Bronx Records right now to help them get through it, you know.
Like, it has been such a rad reminder that way too, of just like, you know, like, in speaking of value, it's like it has, I mean, you know, you have those moments where it's like definitely like the, you know, like what's my purpose? What does it really matter in a world that's, you know, going to hell? But at the same time, like, it's been so cool to see, you know, fans of not only the Bronx and El Bronx, but just in general, you know, supporting artists and you know, kind of, you know, really going the extra mile to be there, you know, whether it's, you know, stupid shit like buying a shirt or just overall, just like, you know, like being able to be in contact with your fans over social media, you know, during times like these is super cool, you know, because it's a good way to just kind of reach out and just be in touch with each other. And it's rad because, I mean, I tell you, it's like, you know, I did my taxes, like, I don't know, like 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, whatever. I was just super late on them. And I was going through all my bank statements and I was like seeing like all this random shit, you know, it's like Taco Bell in Minneapolis or whatever, you know? And I was getting all bummed out, and I was like, fuck, man, I miss traveling so much. I miss like playing shows. I was going through all my statements and seeing all this stupid shit I was buying on tour, you know? And I was just like, God, you know, I miss that stuff so much, you know? And it's like, man, it's so fortunate to just be able to have that, have a community of people who, you know, you can, you know, engage with and just, you know, who supports you, whether it's, you know, digitally or on the road or whatever, you know. And it's like, it's so cool to have that, you know. And it's like, honestly, it's like, it's the best thing ever, man. It's like, and I can't, you know, I can't wait to get back to it, obviously. And I know at some point there's going to be some version of a future, you know. It's like, whether it's completely, you know, completely different and it's never the same, is, you know, if that's the way it shakes out, then that's the way it shakes out, and we'll adjust and we'll go forward. But, you know, I'm just, it's another thing that you realize in these types of situations is how much you have to be grateful for, you know, and it's just like, I rely on that so much because it's like, you know, the band has meant like so much to me, you know. It's like, it's not being in the band, it's everything that being in a band brings to your life, you know. It just brings for me, it's so much validation, you know, just who I am as a human being with, you know, the guys that I create with, you know, and it's like the experiences of traveling the world and meeting people in different countries and, you know, late night conversations about music and art and, you know, being able to just have this amazing life full of memories. You know, that would have never happened if I had not picked up a microphone, you know? So I'm so thankful for all that. So it's like, you know, as you can tell from just the first 30 minutes of this conversation, it's like, there's so much on like the emotional spectrum that you can go through on like a fucking daily basis, you know, when you're just sitting here thinking, you know? So, right? It's great, man. It's super, super crazy times right now. And it's like, there's so much to think on, to reflect on, to act on, you know, so, you know, you just gotta try your best to be present, you know?
Makes sense, man. Who would have known that you jumping out into the crowd all those times would have turned into a public health crisis, you know? That's,
I know. I feel somewhat responsible.
You couldn't have known. So, Matt, we have a fun segment on this show. It would be a good time to turn the corner anyway, called Mystery Friend.
Okay.
I speak to an old friend of yours, get a great story. You have to tell me a little bit about this story and then guess which friend told me.
Oh,
speaking
God.
Of road memories, I had employed Pete Steinkopf of the Bouncing Souls to give me a great story. I figured you guys have spent quite a few nights together. And Pete texted me this morning saying he's got nothing.
He's got nothing.
So I told him on this podcast, I'm going to start his smear campaign and besmirch his good name throughout the Going Off Track community.
Well, no, that's good on Pete because he's keeping quiet.
I figured Pete might be up to some like Sigliere stuff. Yeah, where he's keeping quiet for a reason. I had a feeling that Pete could have been it. Yeah. But so I did dig up another one, which is something I want to talk about anyway. Okay. So I was told, you know, I live in Jersey City, New Jersey. And I don't know if you ever remember being in this place, but apparently one time you slept at an apartment in Jersey City. People were chilling and drinking and eventually went to bed, and you were still enjoying the evening. Eventually got bored and left. Mm-hmm. And the next morning, the person you were staying with was walking their dogs and found you sleeping next to a trash can on the street.
Yeah.
Can you give me a little insight into that story, and maybe and then harbor a guess as to who told me such story?
Well, okay, so it was at Carl Ferret's house. That's where it was, and you know, it was like in the early Bronx days. Every time you know we ended up in Jersey, we would be at Carl's place. And that, cause it was at, and so we were at his spot and.
Yeah, it was, Dixon Mills, right? It was an old converted, it's the converted Dixon Ticonderoga pencil factory that's been turned into like warehouse studio apartments.
And he was like kind of running Ferret like out of there pretty much, you know? So. It was super cool. We go over there, we party, and we'd hang out, you know. And yeah, that night I was hammered drunk, and we were hanging, and I just didn't want to stop, you know. So it was like I just headed out the door, and I was just gonna go look for some drinks and some food. And it was like it was kind of like, you know, the end of The Shining. When he's looking for Danny or whatever, he's got the axe, and he's just in the maze, you know. And he's just like, that was pretty much me on the streets, you know. I was like, I was just looking for action, assuming that there was just going to be, you know, it was going to be easy to find. You know, next thing you know, it was freezing cold, and I had no idea where I was. So I just kind of did what any good punk would do and just huddled up next to a trash can and just, you know, fell asleep.
Just had to sit down and faded through the night, huh?
Yeah, and then the second half of that was when I did wake up and got back to Carl's place. It was obviously, you know, it's always those situations you wake up super early, you know, because you're just like, So I got back, and his two dogs, they were like greyhounds, and of course, he had a small spot, and so the band was, you know, any good real estate was taken, you know what I mean, and hard floors and stuff like that. Sure. So I got in the dog bed, and I slept in the dog bed, and the amount of hair that was in the dog bed was just like, it was unfathomable. It was insane. It was like out of the two dogs' hair, there was like a third dog, you know? So I slept in that thing, and I was like picking dog hair off me for a week after that.
So you had a night. I should mention, too, that in those days, you know, this is probably close to, you know, what? 12, 13, almost 15 years ago, maybe. Like, who knows, right?
Yeah. For sure. And 2003 or 4, something like that. Probably 4.
Yeah, sounds right. And you know, that was kind of like the beginning of the real, like, Jersey City gentrification, you know? Like, Dixon Mills was one of the few spots that was built up. Like, there was a high potential for you to get into some kind of next level, low down New Jersey stuff. Like,
that's what I was told. And yeah, you know, there was an angel watching out for me that night. I've had a couple of those angels looking out for me. But yeah, those are always good times, man. How close is Hoboken close to Jersey City?
Yeah. Like right across, basically there's Jersey City, you cross the Holland Tunnel, then there's Hoboken. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember because I was kind of associate that time with like playing. We used to play Maxwell's all the time.
Yeah,
and those shows were so much fun.
Definitely saw you guys at one of those for sure.
So awesome, man! I think
you called your mystery friend early on. It was Carl Severson, Carl from Fair Records. I wrote a text to both him and Portland, you know, who also worked at Ferret at the time.
And Portland, do you ever hear those Pete Rose stories, Portland?
The Pete Rose?
Yeah.
He's got a Pete Rose story?
No, he used to do this thing, we'd call it, like Pete Rosen, because he used to slide. He used to be able to like slide across like cars, like windshields, and like he would get so drunk, that dude. Yes. That dude would like, he was yeah. like a party, he was like yeah. Yeah, like the guy at the office who got too drunk, you know, shirt off. Like he'd yes. like he had like, you know, like a very, very chill place, and he would be very unchill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been through that situation a number of times. Literally, I was like 22 years old, and I would get asked to go tour with Nora just because I was friends with him, you know? And yeah. somehow, like the 22-year-old in the group, you know, Carl and Portland are getting into their mid to late 20s already. But literally my job on those tours was like to watch those two.
Yeah.
And to like make sure that it just didn't fly like too far off the handle. And I failed like a couple of times because I have some of my crazier moments and stories in life happened with those two out on the road. Because, you know, there's also the thing that was like the height of when Carl was doing pretty well, you know? So. Yeah. So, like, it was kind of gangster for me. Like, I'd go on a Nora tour, and they'd be like, yeah, we're getting a room. I'm like, a room? Hotel room? I'm like, the Ferret credit card? You sure? You know, and it was pretty luxury for me.
Yeah. Those early days were so out of control. And I was so, I mean, I was out of control, but I was also so, like, just green, dude. Like, I was just, you know, right. I was out of my element all the way, and just didn't really know how to, like, you know, in those situations when you're, you know, younger and you're just kind of like trying to, like, it's like, that's why I was just drink out of control and just party out of control. Cause it was the only way to kind of like I just, you know, kind of feel a little comfortable, you know, cause it was like, it was so crazy. I mean, it was like, going from, you know, like, you know, the everything happened with the Bronx so quick, you know, it was like, and then, you know, doing like all the like kind of East Coast, like hardcore stuff. It was just like, it was just super like weird scene, you know, like to be dropped into, you know what I mean? It was just like, and it was super rad. But it was just kind of like, it was just crazy. So I was just raging nonstop.
Yeah. I mean, speaking of that beginning, like, you know, you guys had just that really unique start. Could you speak on that a little, like what actually happened within the first, you know, 6 months of you being a band and the first couple shows and now in hindsight, do you think that was like positive or negative, like in the long run for your career and stuff like that? Like, can you talk about
it? It was 100% positive, man. It's like, yeah. I think, you know, early on, I mean, you just gotta, the approach was just throw them in the deep end, you know,
right.
and you know, sink or swim. And it was that type of thing. And it's like, that's kind of, you know, the way it had to be. It's like, you know, when we first started the band, we had two managers who were just buddies that were like helping us out and looking out for us, is Jonathan Daniel and Pablo Matheson. And Jonathan, you know, he built Crush Music. It's his right. empire. And so he is, you know, both guys are great dudes. Jonathan is an absolute genius. And it's like, you know, their kind of whole thing was, you know, just, don't give them anything, you know, it's like music, you know, the music industry is so used to people bending over backwards for them, doing whatever they want, you know, it's like, we're going to generate this like buzz about you guys. And when people ask for it, we're going to tell them to fuck off, you know?
How did those guys find you, you know, before you were, you hadn't played that many shows yet.
So check this out. So the way the Bronx kind of like the way it broke down is like member to member was like, so, you know, Joby started the band. Joby right. at the time was playing in a band called Let Down, and I knew we had, you know, he was playing with friends David and Vincent, who I grew up with, who, you know, we still play music with to this day, but they were kind of guys that I grew up with that Joby had, he was playing with. So Joby and I, like met that way. We also, my brother was friends with Joby. So there was just a bunch of mutual shit that brought Joby and I together. I was like the kind of weird, like unpolished, like weird guy out in left field. Okay. Joby, Joby was like, you know, Joby had the cool, he had the job at Vagrant Records and, you know, he was doing graphic design, playing guitar. And then, so Jorma, our original drummer, he was in a band called Death on Wednesday, and they had like a good amount. They had like professional buzz, you know. They had like been on like a tour with Social Distortion. They were kind of like professional, like, you know, they were like the guys that, you know, there's like, you know, it's like there's like even on the smallest scales, right? There's levels, right? There's
they like, had those times,
you had
they were
like
doing the thing. They were doing
like,
the
or,
thing.
Like you had a high school band, or it's like okay, or that you actually could get club shows,
right?
You know, you were getting that you could get like signed to like Fearless Records or something like that. You know what I mean? So it was just like okay, so but they were like kind of on that next level, you know? They had like the they had their shit together, you know?
Yeah,
and so. You know, and so Jorma was the guy who kind of brought that in.
Okay.
To, so basically, Joby started the Bronx. He asked Jorma and James, who was working with Joby at Vagrant, to play bass. And then, so Joby knew me, and he was like, okay, I got this kind of wild card guy that you know that I want to introduce you guys to. I think you should sing in the band because we at this point Joby and I were playing in a band called The Drips with Dave and Vince, we were just kind of doing we were making a bunch of music, you know, we were just having fun. So Joby wanted to go, you know, he wanted to get serious about it, so you know, he brought me in on that. I was like, hey, do you want to sing on this stuff? And I was like, yeah, man, of course, you know, let's do it. So we ended up, you know, getting together and playing in downtown rehearsal at our spot, and it just kind of clicked that way. And it was just like, even you know, me with no experience and not really, you know, knowing anything, I felt it. You know, I felt like, okay, like you hear, you know enough about music and bands to know that it's all about chemistry and it's all about the right people. You know, so it's like this felt like it felt. Special. It felt really good.
Nice.
You know, so, and it was like, but it was, when we got three songs together, and it was Jorma who gave them to his buddy Pablo, and it was Pablo who gave it to Jonathan.
Do you remember what those first three were?
Yeah, I think it was Strobe Life, False Alarm, and White Tar. I think that's
Great. Yeah.
I think so. And then so those guys hear the songs, and of course they're like, fuck, this is, you know, this, your shit is that good.
Right.
You know, but so it was super cool, you know, cause they were interested right away. Like, hey, we want to help you guys out. So it was like, cool. Rad.
Yeah.
So then they just kind of built from there, and it was like, literally, I mean, it was so cool to like be on like the bubble of like the whole kind of old school, like music industry, because it was like right at the tail end before it kind of all went to shit as far as like record deals and all that stuff. Like I remember there was this band, fuck, it was like there was, do you remember that band Vendetta Red?
I do, yeah.
They got like a $1 zillion record deal. I remember that, and I was just like, holy shit, you know what I mean? Like these bands is like fucking. So it was that time, you know. It was kind of like the end. It was like the end of that kind of weird drive-in wave where, you know, everyone was just kind of, labels were just signing bands, you know what I mean? Yeah,
and it ended up being like probably what, like the last run of it too.
Yeah, straight up. It was, dude. It was. And so, you know, we ended up getting, you know, man, some of the early shows, like, you know, you look back on them and you remember them with such like, you know, there's such fondness and it's so great. And then you're like, I think there's like, we have like a VHS of our first show, like one of our early shows, The Troubadour. Man, it's not good. but I mean, I'm looking at it from, you know, whatever, critical. But
Yeah, of course.
You know, so that, you know, that kind of just built from there. And then we kind of, you know, we started sending out, we started getting label interests, and then we started sending back, like, you know, just stupid shit to fuck with them. And then, of course, that just built from there. And Jonathan and Pablo were able to kind of build this, like, old school, like, bidding war over a band that had been together for maybe 6 months and had three songs.
What kind of, you know, what kind of dumb shit were you sending back to people? Like, people you weren't interested in? You were just, you were giving them...
Yeah. Like, fart, you know, like, yeah, like this, the one guy, like, I think one guy, the one label asked us, you know, for to send him the rock. And so we literally sent him, like, a box of rocks.
Good. Anyone who says that? Oh, yeah,
I think Joby responded to an email in like some sort of Morse code or something like that. It was just like, it was, you know, it was just whatever. We were just fucking with people, and it was super cool. And then, you know, so yeah, and you know, Jonathan, you know, lined us up with Gilby Clark to kind of finish the record, and that was a big thing. You know, it was insane. So then at that point, you know, we got, you know, oh, dude, so we went to this one record label meeting, and I wish I could remember who it was, but this guy, like, took our song and, like, pitch shifted it down.
Oh, like, no.
Wait, he's like, how about that? That feels good, right?
No.
We're like, whoa, this is so retarded. Like, we're out of here. You know?
Bad. Yeah. And you had a little bit of a reputation too, from what I heard, for really, like, sucking the meat out of these meetings too. I heard, like, you really,
I mean, I was really trying
to drain the cards, right?
Yeah, I was trying, man. I mean, you know, it's like, I was doing the best I could to get, you know, I mean, I was living off of nothing, you know, it's like Joby kept me alive for a solid year. I would go into Vagrant. And now he would just give me boxes of Vagrant CDs, and I would go to Amoeba and just sell them.
Oh, wow.
it was amazing, you know? It was just like, because at that time, that was good money.
Sure.
I mean, you had like, you know, I was getting like, you know, $4 or $5 a CD, man.
Yeah, baby,
like,
those are hot titles.
Yeah, dude. and man, if there was like a box set or anything like that, then woo.
Woo.
You know,
going to Sizzler
Hell yeah. So, yeah, we do these meetings, you know, and I'd ask people for cash, you know, I'd do all that shit. But it was a good time, man. We did, like, you know, Island took us out to New York. We did, like, the whole, like, just completely just scripted, like, take the rock band to a strip club, you know, thing. And it was. Just like you would always think it was just fucking, it was perfect. It was magical.
Yeah.
You know,
it was
totally dumb. But we got to do all that and experience all that and kind of the last wave of that. And I mean, I don't know, maybe it's come back around nowadays, but I don't think it has, you know,
Not like that.
Yeah. It was super cool to kind of get in at the end of that rainbow, you know? So we ended up signing a deal with Island that was super cool. Not like a $1 million deal by any means, but we got what we wanted. We got a little bit of cash to pay off some bills, buy a van, go on tour. You know, we got the first record to be able to come out through Parrot. We got a Ferret. We got to build our own label, White Drugs. We got to got to be able to have control of everything we wanted to do and build it out from there. And it was all because of Jonathan and Pablo. I mean, we had an idea of what we wanted. But, you know, if we didn't have those guys, I mean, we would have been raked over the coals.
Yeah, sure. You guys managed to have leverage right from the get.
We had guys that were really looking out for us, you know. So it was we were super fortunate in that respect. You know, it was kind of a really good thing that lined up for us. So, you know, and from there, I mean, you know, it's just all gas, no brakes, right? It's like you get the deal. You get the deal, next you're out on the road, you're making records, and you're just going. So, I mean, for us, it was really it's the only way I could ever see it happening, honestly. You know, it was kind of like, I mean, because we had the connection between the four of us, like, instantly, you know, like, we were different, you know, like, we were different, like Jorma and I, James and I, and like, everyone had, like, their own personalities, but we were all we also had, you know, we bonded right away, you know, and it's like, and it was, you know, a super beautiful thing, you know, and to be able to experience all that, you know, I mean, you're traveling, you're making music, you're partying your face off, you're doing all these things, and it's happening so fast. Yeah, I mean, it was incredible, man, you know, and it's like, and honestly, it still is, you know, it's still get the exact same, you know, like pull from it as it did back then. It's just, back then it was just all a blur, I'm still drinking, I still do all that shit, you know, but it's like, it was just the pace. You know, when everything first started, it was just like insane. I mean, it was just like go, 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 and everything was just out of control. But yeah, man, I mean, I think that's the only way it could have gone down. I mean, it's like, you know, for us to try to be more methodical about what we were doing or anything like that, or to take too much time to try to, you know, formulate any sort of like critical strategy would have been a big mistake.
Yeah, and you certainly didn't need it. I mean, that first record came out, and for anyone who hadn't heard you first, you know, it wasn't like, oh, this is just their first record. It's like, holy shit, what is this? This is fucking, you know? And I remember, too, like, having a little bit of a break. You know, I saw you guys, you know, really early a bunch with the Ferret guys, and then, you know, I hadn't seen you in a couple years and ran into you at a festival. And yeah. I was like, I wonder what these guys are like if they're still rocking it hard, or if they're like just totally pro like festival band now. And I remember you had an early set. It was like a 1 o'clock or something. And I see you guys popping out from the backstage. You know, we kind of see each other. We're like, oh, what's up, man? I sort of remember you from like New Brunswick, you know, and I see Jorma looking a little pale. And he walks on stage and just like puts a finger in his mouth, does like a really, really perfect, clean puke off the back of the stage, and then just like runs right up and starts, you know, playing like he does, which was, you know, phenomenal at the time. And I'm just like, oh, okay, they're still doing it. And he even took a reprieve, I think, like after like the third song, went back and did like another one in about 10 seconds and was back just ripping it. And I'm like, oh man, the Bronx are still the Bronx. I love this.
Oh yeah. It was, those are like the most, I mean, dude, it's like that. Those are the most like, you know, it's like, that shit is so awesome. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you know what I mean? Like, you're like the fact that, I mean, and you're not, you know, you might not, the reality of the situation is you might not be playing your best show, you know, but it's like that feeling of like, you know, rolling out of a Sprinter van in like the fucking middle of nowhere, or like, you know, and just like getting on stage and, you know, in some festival and, you know, just plugging in and playing is like, dude, it's the fucking best. I mean, it's like, it's so rad, you know? And it's like, you know, it's so cool to be able to do that with your friends, you know, and just and to be able to make it last, you know? So, but yeah, dude, I mean, we did the whole thing, you know? So like after the first record, the second record was like the major label one we did with Rhinehorn. And that was like a full on, you know, just massive undertaking, but
yeah,
just
an like awesome, media blitz kind of stuff.
Yeah, it was just an awesome experience, but it was like full on, you know, like military, you know, break down, build you back up thing. Right, but it was, a super rad experience. But that was like it was a long time between our first and second record. You know, it was like I remember it feeling like a really long time, and it was. I think it was like almost like 3 years or something like that. Wow. But yeah, man, it just kept going, you know, and it's like that was like the thing that I've always loved and I still love about the band. It's just like, you know, we're tight, you know. It's like there's a friendship between everybody, you know, and it's like with the new guys, I can't even call them the new guys. I mean, Brad and Ken have been in the band for, you know, well over a decade now. It's like, but it's like we're brothers, you know? So it's like, it's so much fun to be able to play music together. And It's like, I don't know, man. It's hard to put it into words how appreciative I am of it, because I love it so much.
I can hear it in your voice, man. It's always.
And Matt, where did the mariachi thing come from?
Los Angeles, man. I mean, it came out. So we had, you know, like I was saying, we had that downtown rehearsal spot, which is now like a Soho. I don't know what it is. It was a legendary rehearsal spot. It was so rad. You know, there was
then, where was that studio? Is it in downtown LA? Or?
Yeah, Santa Fe and 7th Street, I think. It's like, you know, now it's by the, there's a strip club there called the Playpen. but then it was sketchy as hell. But yeah, now it's like, now there's like the Stumptown.
Okay.
And there's
Urban,
like
an Outfitters or something.
Well, no, I mean, it's not like fully bad, but it's like, it's definitely not the way it was, you know, but it's all good. Things change, whatever.
The Stumptown, dude, the coffee place is always the first domino in gentrification.
Yeah, you know, so. And we had like, you know, I mean, obviously in LA, Hispanic culture is everywhere, you know what I mean? I grew up surrounded by it. You know, our rehearsal spot, there was a Mexican car wash, you know, right across the street, and we would be playing, and every time we stopped playing, you know, it would just be mariachi music or, you know, banda music, just like, just badass, just bumping. You know what I mean? Just beautiful tunes, just cruising out, you know, speakers and just everyone partying, having a good time, just working, you know, it's just like, you know, kind of classic culture, you know? So, it's just something that kind of like subliminally, like kind of like snuck into our studio in our ears in that way. And it's like, you know, when we were kind of having a little bit of a, like a, we hit, you know, I feel like every punk band hits a wall at some point if you want to like try to like break out of it, you know what I mean, or like do something a little different. So around our third record, that's where we were kind of sitting. We were like, you know, it's like
what next?
Yeah, like what next, you know, like what are we gonna do here? We gotta be
it's a big next.
You know, we feel like we just need to do like something, you know, like what do we want to do? And we had kind of started getting like, you know, like we had like an offer from, there used to be this thing that I remember, you guys remember Fuel TV, but Fuel TV was they had like a Daily Habit show or something like that. And they wanted us to do an acoustic Bronx song. And that was kind of at the time, you know, that was like, you know, that was like an insult, you know.
Yeah,
it was like,
right. We don't do acoustic.
Yeah, the Bronx does not do acoustic, bro. You know? But we wanted to do the show, you know? So we were like, okay, let's try and figure out a creative solution to it. And, you know, lo and behold, music coming in, you know, through the windows, you know, and Joby's like, hey, you know, let's try to do something mariachi style. You know, let's try to take Dirty Leaves, which is a song off our second record, kind of like our first kind of like slower song. Mm-hmm. And put some, you know, some different instrumentation to it and you know, see what happens, you know. Right. So that was the birth of it, you know. So we put that together and it just felt amazing. I mean, it felt nerve-wracking. It felt like super inspiring, really creative and challenging, you know, and just like unknown, you know. It was just like, it just took us completely 100% out of our safe space.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, like, did you have any mariachi groups or music that was like already part of your listening, you know, your listening Rolodex, or
I mean, like,
did it kind of trickle down after?
Well, so I mean, we had a little bit. So it's like, so going back to the kind of musical family that we got going here, you know, so I met David and Vince Hidalgo in I want to say I was a sophomore in high school.
Okay.
My first girlfriend was their cousin.
Okay.
So I didn't know anything about them at all. I didn't know, you know, so she kind of like didn't bring me over there until like I like she knew I was like a, you know, I was like a
legit person. Prospect.
Yeah, legit prospect. Exactly. Yeah.
Double A. You had to crack double A.
Yeah. Right. So like, she's like, okay, I'm going to bring you. And so I'm like, I'm in my head. I'm just like, what? Like, what is the big deal? You know what I mean? Like, what's going on? So, and it was never anything like that. So I go over there and, you know, I meet David, who's a year older than me, but we were basically, you know, same age. And
yeah.
And so, you know, we meet and I meet Vincent, who at that time was so young. It's hilarious. and we hit it off right away. And then it's like, I don't really realize anything until the first, but, you know, eventually it comes out that, you know, their dad is the singer in Los Lobos. And
right.
I mean, this is kind of like, you know, after like not, you know, not too far after La Bamba and, you know, Colors and all that. I mean, they were cranking out tunes. I mean, they were a big deal.
Pretty
you
know much I mean? The face of that music to like any American was right. them. Yeah.
Yeah. 100%. And I'm, you know, I'm hanging out in the living room and, you know, I'm just like, so you know, cool. And they've taken me in and they're super cool. And, you know, so it's like, and so, you know, I'm over there all the time, you know, hanging out with them and her and it just became this thing where, you know, eventually, you know, we started playing music together and, you know, in their basement playing cover songs and just doing stuff like that. And so we just became friends and tight and just obviously, you know, so it just built from there. But from that's kind of when, you know, I started to really get into Los Lobos, you know, like outside of like what I'd heard or seen, you know, from movies or soundtracks. And I really started to discover that side of music, you know, it's like, but then that was like, I mean, and they're, you know, obviously, you know, monsters of the genre, you know? Course, so it's like, you know, that's kind of where musically, you know, where any sort of real kind of understanding or appreciation started for me, you know, and then obviously, you know, as you know, our kind of musical circle kind of grew outwards and Jovi meets those guys and then everyone kind of, you know, we all kind of, it kind of grew outward from there. So Lobos was definitely kind of the main, you know, like what we wanted to like, the only thing we knew to kind of like AB against, you know what I mean? Like we were kind of
that's
using
a
that.
Big, that's a big standard,
I mean,
dude, man.
It's a good A.
I mean, and honestly, dude, I mean, and it's like, if you know that and you listen to El Bronx, you can hear it, you know? And it's like, and it's like, if I mean, it's nowhere near, you know, I'm not saying it's anywhere near what they're doing. I'm just saying that's what we were like, you know, at least for me, but like specifically vocally, like that's what I was trying to be. You know what I mean? Like I was like, I want to sound like he's got the greatest voice, like one of the greatest voices of all time to me.
Yeah.
Like his voice is just insane. It's just so, it's just beautiful, man. It's just beautiful. And it's like, you know, that was kind of like what I want, you know, like what I wanted to like, where I wanted to end up. Like if I can kind of go somewhere in this direction, you know, hopefully it'll be all right. You know what I mean? So, you know, going off of that. And then plus, you know, we have, you know, with Vincent was such a big part of El Bronx because, you know, with everyone kind of feeling their way around, you know, the genre and the instrumentation and the rhythms, Vince was the authenticator. You know, Vincent was the one who was like, okay, not like that, like this, you know, this is that, let's do it this way. It's got to be done. Like, so he was kind of like, you know,
he's like the conductor almost in a way.
Yeah. He kind of helped us. He helped the tree grow straight. You know what I mean?
Right. It's like when there's like a cop movie and they have to make sure there's like a cop on set, you know, to make sure like all the cops are acting like real cops or something.
Exactly. You know, exactly. Cause we were coming from obviously, you know, a place of, you know, ultimate respect and appreciation and, you know, just wanting to do this out of pure creativity and inspiration and love of music, you know, but we were also super aware that people might think, we were taking a piss out of the culture, out of the music, or that just going to be like, you know, these fucking white dudes are disrespecting fucking, you know, Mexican music, all this shit, you know? So, you know, and it was like, that's the one thing that we just, you know, you never, I mean, coming up, anybody who values, you know, any sort of moral compass, whether it's, you know, personally, creatively, you know, you never want to be seen as fake, you know, you never want to be seen as fake, you know? So that was the number one thing, you know? And so it was like, we got to do this right, you know? And so, you know, we worked our asses off to do it right, to make it our own. And, you know, we leaned on Vincent a lot in the early days to kind of make sure that we were doing things the right way, you know?
Right. You guys are bold, man. I mean, between being from Los Angeles and calling your band the Bronx, and then you know, being white guys who decide to take on Marriott. I mean, you're fucking bold. You know, if there's anything you say about the Bronx, you boys are bold. You know.
You know. That's
awesome, man. Now, like lyrically, you know, is there like a way to convey mariachi music that's antithetical to the way you would convey like a punk song? You know, I know you're not always talking about like, you know, fucking punk rock. Like, you know, you write kind of love songs anyway a lot of the time. But is there a different way to convey them in a mariachi setting than in a punk setting?
Yeah, I mean, I you know, for me, originally, and still, for the most part, it's like, you know, and this was the thing that I didn't even, that was like the most insanely freeing thing to me. Because like, you know, there is, in punk music and in aggressive music, there is kind of a rallying cry to sing, you know, to be against, you know, to be screaming, about what's wrong and not about what's right, you know? And that's kind of the school that I grew up in, you know, it's like, it was all about fuck you, you know? I mean, that was it, you know? And it was like, fuck you, fuck this, you know, burn it down.
Question,
you
know? Everything.
So,
yeah.
So, you know, and what you don't realize is how, what I didn't realize is how kind of one-sided that can make you as a human being.
Sure.
You know? And so I had all these great things that I experienced in my life. You know, I've got, you know, a great family. I've got, you know, I grew up in this awesome neighborhood, and I've lived this, you know, life that isn't anything like crazy, but you know, it's like it's been, I have a lot to be thankful for.
Sure.
And it had all just kind of been over my head until El Bronx came along, and it was like, it was kind of like the first time that I felt okay about singing about, you know, like positive things, or like, you know, things that have gone right in my life, or things that I appreciate, or singing like honestly, confidently about love, you know, because usually in Bronx, it would just be like, if I was singing about love, you know, I would make it like tortured, you know, it would be like a dirty fucking strung out, you know, nasty punk rock gutter love.
Like,
you know?
A Sid and Nancy love.
Yeah. You know, it was like, it just, El Bronx became this, it was just this thing, and it brought so much like being able to like, to have an outlet for kind of like all the other emotions in life.
Yeah.
Like, it balanced out my whole existence, dude.
Wow.
Like, it was like crazy.
That sounds
like,
really so freeing.
Yeah, it was. And honestly, that's why it was like, it was so crazy when it all happened, and we were writing, dude. It was like, dude, it was just like, it was flowing out of all of us, you know? It was like, like, for me, lyrics and melody and all that stuff was just like, it was just coming. So it was just like, it was super inspiring and just super, just, you know, beautiful to kind of experience it. And
very cool.
Yeah. So for me, there is a difference, and it's like, it starts with that. It's basically, you know, Bronx is basically, you know, pissed off, and El Bronx is way more celebratory and way more appreciative and happy. But at the same time, You know, it's a very beautiful music, but it can be very sad, and you know, it can be very, you know, just intense, you know. So the more we got into the band, you know, like the second record, third record, the kind of more I started really kind of, you know, experiencing the kind of full spectrum of lyrics and stuff like that. But when we first started, you know, it was just about, honestly, it was just trying to like celebrate instead of just like, you know, being pissed off all the time.
Yeah.
You know,
has it made you a more well-rounded lover?
Of course. Of course, you know, because it's like, I feel like, you know, it's like, you, it's like punks, like, I don't know, I wouldn't stop talking.
No. Matt, don't stop talking. Because there's got to be a difference. Because there's got to be a difference between drunk, angry punk rock sex and beautiful, loving mariachi sex. Like,
that's what I'm saying. It's fucking and making love, you know? It's like those are the two things, you know? It's like, that's pretty much it, you know?
Yeah. Oh, that's awesome. I love it. So. The Bronx live show is always an experience, and I know you guys pride yourself in that. And you know, more often than not, you know, I'll turn my head and be back and be like, "Oh, where's Matt?" And you'll be, you know, down in the crowd, getting dirty, mixing it up with everyone. How do you prepare for a show like that? And like, do you have any rituals that like you have to do to get on stage?
Not really. I mean, okay. I do, depending on where I'm at vocally on tour, I may warm up here and there, but it's like, as far as like getting ready to like play a show, you know, it's like, I used to drink beers and just hang out, but now it's like, I don't drink before we play anymore.
Okay.
It's 'cause I just realized I just sing way better, you know, and right, it's like, right. I'll just have some beers after the show, you know? So it's like, it's a lot that kind of small, like kind of like change in the routine was a big one for me. 'Cause it just, I just felt so much better about how I was singing and the show overall, you know, right. But it's like, as far as like getting hyped to like go play, get in the crowd or whatever, it's like, I don't know, man. I'm ready for it. It's
you
like,
just
I,
come like, hyped. Pre-hyped.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm hyped on. I'm ready to go. You know, it's like I love it, man.
That's nice to hear. See, yeah, that's that California thing we go back to again. It's just pure positivity. You know what I mean? People just come a different way. A guy from New York is going to go play a Bronx show. He's going to have to go through an hour of deep reflection, maybe some cocaine. Have a conversation with like his aunt, like it's gonna be a whole fucking thing. You're just from Cali. You're like, you know what? Just get out there and fucking rip it because life is good.
I gotta move
out there, man. Jesus Christ, what are we doing, Brad? You know why are we torturing ourselves?
Hey, man. Sooner or later, the East Coast is gonna be a ghost town.
Yeah, underwater.
Everybody's out here anyways, man. All you motherfuckers are moving out here,
Man. I want an orange tree and a good night's sleep, you know? I'm coming for you, Matt. So you got to tell me a story, because it's one of the strangest things I saw on tour ever in all my years of touring. And I need some clarification on your end as to what the hell was going on. So we were on the Soundwave tour together in Australia. And you know, we were at different parts of the festival. I didn't get to see you very often because of the way we were separated. And, you know, Pennywise was also on the tour. It was the first time I'd gotten to know Fletcher at all. He actually was in our traveling party. And, you know, during the day, I had a couple really great conversations with him. He did inherently terrify me just in general because of his size and demeanor.
Yeah, he's a great white, man. He's a great white.
Yeah, and I remember, so I go and try to catch you guys. I believe it was the last night of the tour, and I'm on stage, and I see Fletcher on the other side of the stage really getting into a handle of vodka and starting to get pretty hyped up. And, you know, I'm on the other side of the stage being like, you know what, I'm going to stay over here because I don't know what's about to happen. And before I know it, maybe it was my sixth sense, Fletcher was on stage with you guys. I remember seeing maybe a couple headlocks where he started giving you some vodka. And then eventually turned into like a broken bottle. Him cutting his chest, throwing the bottle into the crowd. Like really, really wild stuff. And you guys were all up for it while it was happening. But can you give me your memory of this situation and what actually happened?
Yeah, well, that was like, you know, that was like building of like, you know, that was like an epic kind of just grand finale, you know? It's just right. Like, that was, you know, so Fletcher's a good friend of mine and the band's, and it's like that, you know, that tour was so much fun. And when you go down to Australia, it's like, Australia's the best. Oh. You know, it's like, you know that. It's like, it's just, it's such a special place, especially for rock and roll music, for punk rock music, for garage music. I mean, they fucking love it. You know?
Yeah.
They live it, they breathe it. It's a vibe. And it's like, and going back to California, you know, I used to compare Australia to like, it's like California Island, you know?
Yeah,
it's like,
can see it.
It's like, it's just like, you know, it's like, what, like coastal, like kind of surfing and rock and roll and just kind of easy. I don't know. It's an amazing place. So when we go down there, we let it all hang out extra. You know what I mean? It's always just a little bit more. And, you know, and Fletcher was on that tip with us, you know, so we playing and that night he was hammer drunk and it's like, I'm looking at him on the side of the stage and he's like cross-eyed, you know?
Yeah.
And he's got the big old thing of vodka and he comes out during History Stranglers. And he comes out, he puts me in a headlock and gives me some vodka. And then he grabs Mike, he says, like, the Bronx is the fucking best, or something like that. You know what I mean? Like, this is like out of nowhere. And then he grabs the bottle and he fucking slams it down and it just shatters. And then he grabs a piece of the glass and he lifts his shirt up and he just starts slicing his stomach up. And dude, I mean, and like, and doing damage, dude, the scar he's got is insane. So he sliced himself to shit and I'm like looking at it like, whoa, like, you know, I'm still singing the song. And then of course, you know, he comes at me and then I'm just like, ah, shit, you know? So then he's like, punch me. Oh my God. He tells me to punch him. So I'm pretty sure I punched him. I don't remember if I did. It wasn't anything noteworthy, that's for sure.
Right. Not a haymaker.
At this point he's a hurricane.
Yeah.
And so he picks me up, you know, he's hugging me and slamming me. We wrestle on the ground. I got his blood all over me, you know what I'm saying? So then it's just one of these things. And, you know, the crowd's going crazy. Everyone's like, what the fuck is happening?
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, we end the set. I think Jorma ends up trashing the drums or something. It just turns into a big mess. So then we get backstage. And he is cut to shit. And
real cut, like this needs attention,
like
cut.
Stitches.
Multiple stitches, dude. Like a ton of stitches. Okay. It looks like it literally does look like a shark bit him in the stomach.
Holy shit!
So he gets back there, and then he's got. I mean, he went to the hospital, and like the story he's got about the hospital, about like that, like him wanting to like stitch himself up. Like,
oh my God!
He was a nightmare in the goddamn hospital. God bless the people who put him back together, but.
Did he willingly go to the hospital? Like, he actually was like, I'm going to go to the hospital?
I doubt it.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I doubt it, you know, but he...
I feel like he might have been able to put down first or something.
Yeah, I mean, he's the dude, though, man. I love that guy so much. He's, you know, he's... That's the thing. It's like, one of the things that is really, really cool about, you know, music and art and, you know, especially punk rock, is you come across... You know, you come across people who, you know, who do it, you know, and who appreciate it and who are legit,
yeah.
But they don't really, they're for, they don't, they don't, you know, they, whether it's just a personal choice or just who they are as human beings, they just have control, you know, they have control and they don't really, you don't ever really see them get out of that zone. You know what I mean? But it's like, there's other people, you know, who it's like when you hear an electric guitar or when you hear a song that you fucking love, or you see a band that you fucking dig, it doesn't matter what age you are, who you are, where you are, what you're doing, like, you're gonna fucking lose control, and you're gonna fucking go off, because that's what fucking music does to you, and that was him, and that's me too, and so it's like, you know, so it's like, I get that, and I fucking love that, you know, so it's, so I appreciated that moment so much, and it's like we get there's a lot to, like, if you that episode deserves like its own special, because if you could get him on here to talk about that, dude, that it's amazing. Like there's a whole second half to that story that is just absolutely insane. But I couldn't speak on it for him. You gotta get him.
Sure. All right, we'll try to get Fletcher on. I mean, I even remember being, you know, because I grew up listening to Pennywise. This wasn't some band I just, like, discovered on Soundwave. You know, I was, like, 13 years old singing along to Bro Him. So, you know, I knew exactly who they were, but I'd never met those guys. And I remember Fletcher walking on, like, you know, the way Soundwave tour works is, like, you're in a traveling party with, like, four or five other bands, you know, and you're off and on the bus with them every day when you're going somewhere. You're on flights with them. And I remember Fletcher coming with a guitar with no case. He just had a guitar, like, just was carrying around an electric guitar, like, in the airport, you know, wherever he went, like, up to the hotel room. I'm like, you know, I figured the guy from Pennywise would have a case, you know, would have, like, some extra strings, would have some shit like that. But it was just like, this guy just showed up to Australia with his guitar. And
dude,
do the thing, you know. I was like, this is a remarkable, you know.
It's just like, you know, he's just one of the, he's a classic, dude. He's just a classic, just human being, and just like punk rocker. And it's just like, you know, he's just one of those guys. It's just like, you know, he'll mosh in a hotel lobby. He'll do anything. It's just, it's in his blood, man.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah. You gotta respect it, man. It's like, I think the caveat to guys like that is when you take the control away and you put it in a, like, 6'7", 280-pound body or something, and no one can control that, you know, even when it gets out of control.
Oh, man, there was, I think it was actually the same Soundwave that Queen, because Queens was on that, right?
I think so. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. So there was a night after one of our sets that Josh and Fletcher were backstage.
Oh my God.
They were throwing like huge, like, construction bricks that were like that were basically like around the poles to hold the stage down.
Yeah.
And, I mean, those two together, dude. I mean, those are some giant dudes.
Yeah.
I mean, we were always wondering, like, oh, it'd be such a great fight. Like, I wonder.
Right. I gotta put my money on Fletcher there. Josh is a giant dude, but Fletcher seems to have.
Josh can fight, dude.
He can throw down.
Yeah, Josh can fight.
All right.
Josh can most definitely fight. You know,
the pay per view I want to see. You know?
Yeah. It'd be great. But you know, they're friends, so it's better that way.
Sure.
But those two guys, you know, with some cocktails in them, woo! Yeah. Look out.
Oh, man, that's the thing. I remember being at a festival once, and I don't really know Josh. We'd met him a couple times, and literally within 10 minutes, I think he just took a liking to a couple of the guys in my band. We gave him a little, you know, a little weed, and he was trying to convince us there was some new metal band on the festival, and he's like, let's go to their backstage, just get in their room and start trashing their backstage and, like, fucking with them, you know? And I'm like, I'm like, I don't want to do that. I don't think, you know, I wasn't like punk enough to hang out with Josh Homme at all. Like, I don't think I would have made like 15 minutes without being like, oh yeah, I don't know, man. Cause I'm the other guy you're talking about. I have too much control. So, yeah, I'd be remiss to not ask this, because I know not a lot of Going Off Track fans give a shit, but I give a shit. So, you're a diehard Lakers fan.
Yeah.
Been forever. Can you quickly, I know it's a bummer, but can you quickly tell me, like, where you were at when you found out about Kobe and your kind of immediate and long-term reactions now from that? Like, was he one of your all-time faves?
Oh, for sure, man. Yeah. For sure. I saw Kobe play a bunch of times, man. And I got to see him hit a game winner once in Staples. That was pretty amazing. But so we have, you know, I got a sports thread with, like, you know, my brother and, you know, Brad, you know,
of course,
Brad
Bronx. Yeah. My go-to for anything Louisville.
Hell yeah, he's the man. And he's
the mayor, basically.
Yeah, he just opened a bar in Louisville, too, which is awesome, man.
It's awesome. Respect to Brad. Brad's an old school buddy who's slept at my apartment and stuff before with his old bands. I was super happy to see him be in the Bronx.
Hell yeah, he's the fucking man. So it's him and my brother and a couple other buddies. And, you know, I think it was our buddy Donnie who chimed in first. I was literally just waking up, and it was like, you know, there's a rumor going around that Kobe's dead, you know? It was like, it was like, when it first hit, it was like, okay, it's on TMZ, and then it was off TMZ, and then it was like, it wasn't on the internet. And then, you know, obviously it kind of trickled in. And at first, when it came down that he was dead, it was just like, whoa, holy shit. Like, it still didn't even feel real, honestly. Yeah. It's like, I didn't know the guy, but it was like it's such a crazy thing, you know? Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was so sad. And then it was just, you know, when the news just kept getting worse, you know, and then it was just like, oh man, his daughter was in there. Yeah. And then it was like, oh man, there was like, you know, six other people or whatever it was, you know, it was just like, it was so sad, man. It was just absolutely brutal. And you just feel so bad for, you know, the families. I mean, like, one of the families in there, like, it was like a dad and a mom and a daughter, and they had a daughter outside. So it's like, you have like a daughter, like a girl, that's like a whole family. That's
crazy,
you know
what I mean? Thanks.
And it's just like so intense and so sad and just so fucking weird with the helicopter and the fog and just like
surreal,
so
right? At first, you were just like, wait, what? How is that possible? How is this possible?
Yeah. Yeah. So insane, man. So insane and so sad. And it was like, you know, he was a big basketball hero of mine. Obviously, lifetime Laker fan. I grew up, like, you know, when they were still kind of playing the form, and, you know, it was like, you know, as a kid, it was the, you know, the Magic Squad and, you know, all that, and the, you know, the original, you know, kind of Showtime era. And then, you know, as, you know, the new kind of wave came through with Shaq and Kobe, it was just like, that was like the prime, like those early 2000 squads was just like absolutely insane.
Were you a Kobe or Shaq guy at that time? I know everyone had a side.
Initially, I was the Shaq guy.
You're a Shaq guy. I knew you were a Shaq guy. All punk rockers were Shaq guys.
Well, Shaq Diesel was, dude, he was so dominant. And when, dude, he had like the best dunk ever, dude. When he would just dunk on everybody and just like, it was just pure force. But I always loved Kobe too, but I didn't appreciate Kobe until they kind of, like, once they started really winning, and then when Kobe really established himself as, you know, equal, if not greater, you know, then it was, but to me, you know, he had to kind of earn the respect on Shaq's team and he did it, you know? So, you know, so that was the way it went down for me. But yeah, I mean, when he died, man, it was just heartbreaking, dude. And it's like, it's still one of those things where you think about it and it's like, it's just so strange that he's not around, you know?
Did you get down to Staples Center at all? Were you able to do any of the?
I didn't go down there. It felt weird, you know. And it's like I wanted to go down there, but honestly, I was just, I don't know. I was just too out of it, you know. It's just like I just didn't feel like, I don't know. I just didn't make it. I want to say I regret it, but I don't. I mean, it's like I spent plenty of time, you know, trying to understand it all and watching everything and reading everything and dealing with it in my own way. But, you know, it's like, it's crazy, man. I mean, it's like, you see, you know, I mean, that's the whole other trip about all this stuff is, you know, I mean, you can go at any time, dude.
Yes.
You know, you can go, anybody can go at any time. And that was like the thing. It was just
it was like a strange wake up call in a lot of ways.
You know, you forget about that shit when you're living, man. Yeah. Forget you could die at any second, man. Yeah. You really do.
And even people with burgeoning futures and a million things in front of them suffer the same fate as everyone else. I think it was strange, too, with him and the idea that, you know, even when you start to idolize like a singer or someone in music or something like that, you don't often follow their path from like 16 years old to like grown man with a family. You know, like my favorite singers, you're not so intimately tied with their lives like that. But the way athletes are depicted these days, you know, you knew everything about this guy from the minute he was 16 to the minute he passed. So it did, even for someone like me who's just a giant sports fan, you know, there was this really like obvious loss that felt very tangible, you know, when it happened. And I think that's part of it. It's like you watch the kid grow up and watched him become something different. And then, and like you said, watch someone get taken in an amazingly sudden way that makes you start to think about your own mortality and shit. It turned into a very powerful event because of that, I think.
Full on. And it was a little extra heavy, you know, down here, because he was, you know, he was an Orange County guy, you know. It was right. Like an pilot, and the families, they were all, you know, like one of the baseball coaches lived in Huntington, and another one, the pilot in Seal Beach, which is, you know, everything was like basically, you know, I mean, Newport's kind of the next town south from Huntington, and you know it's like a beach city. It's got, you know, obviously it's super kind of rich Orange County you know sections of it, but it's also got its little, you know, beach rap spots too. But you know, yeah, he was a big figure down here, you know. It was like, and it was crazy too, dude, because obviously being the fan that I was, you know, everyone knew about the helicopter, you know, because he was like a famous story of like his first day, like Laker game, like he didn't understand traffic on the 405 and he was like an hour late.
Right.
And so like from that point on, like he just started figuring out what to do. So you would see his helicopter. I mean, when they would practice in El Segundo over by LAX and all that stuff, you would see him all the time fly from Newport. He would just take the coast. He would just literally, would just this way, like 405 in the air. You know what I mean? So you would see his helicopter go by all the time.
Kobe didn't have time for traffic.
Hell no.
Come on.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like, but yeah, so it's super crazy, you know? And then you just think like, yeah, there's just so many weird things, you know? Like, it's like, you know, there, you know, you get to that point where, you know, you're such a, you know, can't really, you're such a star, you can't really do certain normal things. But then it's like, yeah, fuck, it's like, it's crazy, like, you know, a helicopter, like, they were going to, like, they weren't going far, man. They were going
it was like
a valley or something. So many crazy things. But yeah, it's like, it's just tragic, man. But the saddest thing is obviously the, you know, the kids and stuff like that. And you know, it's like, it's just like, you gotta feel so bad for, you know, his wife and all that stuff. It's just crazy, man. Death is no good, man.
That is a fact, man.
No good. No good.
Well, we've been going a long time, and I bummed you out at the end. But
thanks, bro.
I have the hardest question I need to ask you right now out of the whole hour and 30 minutes. I need your Lakers, the Lake Show, all-time starting five for you. Which I know this is a brutal question, I'm sure, especially for the Lakers, because you got such a storied history. If I was doing this for the Nets, it would take about 4 seconds, you know?
I don't know, man. Probably, you know, Shaq, Magic, Kobe. Do you include LeBron?
Already?
Maybe. I don't know.
No,
it's like,
you can't. Not yet.
I don't think. Yeah, all right. So we got Shaq, Shaq, obviously Kobe Magic. You gotta go Kareem. Mm-hmm. You gotta get the logo in there. You gotta get Jerry West in there probably. I think my top five would be, let's see here. I'm gonna go Shaq, Kobe, Kareem, Magic. I'll throw the logo in there. I'll throw Jerry West in there.
Okay. How can you deny any of those? I was maybe hoping for a James Worthy or a Pau Gasol or something.
I went to Christian High School, right? High School in Whittier, and AC Green came and talked to us about like abstinence, because he was like a virgin for it. And I'm not clowning, okay?
AC Green was a virgin while he was on the Lakers?
Yeah, AC Green was like a virgin till he was like, he might still be a virgin, dude.
Wow.
Yeah, he was like, and it was so funny, dude, because it was high school, you know what I mean? So he comes and he's talking to us about don't have sex, like save yourself till marriage and all this stuff. And we're just like, dude, this guy is, he's a fucking Laker, and this guy is just blowing it, you know? I don't think there was a student in the goddamn gym that wasn't laughing at his ass, you know what I mean? But to each his own. But I'll never forget that, because that was honestly that time in Christianity, I guess you want to call it, for whatever, was so funny, dude. Because I went to Christian high school basically because El Rancho, the high school in my district in Pico, it was heavy, heavy gangs, and my mom really didn't want me to go there. She was just scared to death. So she sent me to school in Whittier. So, and it was cool because I ended up meeting everyone I know and all that shit. So it's all good. But I ended up not graduating because I fucking failed Bible, but that's the thing, right? At Christian high school, you don't graduate unless you pass Bible.
Right. Most. Yeah.
So at the time,
it was, punk rock you.
Well, it was Bible study
and they get out of high school. I mean,
dude, it was so judgmental in that time too. It was just like, like my senior year, I'll never forget. So I got kicked out like halfway through my senior year, and I ended up just graduating like continuation school. But I had Bible my first class senior year, and you go wake up, you'd be like, all right, I'm going to school, and be like, okay, I'm like doing this, I got friends, I'm gonna do, it's cool, it's all good. And you go to Bible first period, and it's like, fucking gays are going to hell. Everyone's, it was hardcore judgment at that time.
Right.
And it's like, it still is to a certain extent now, but things have like, it's not the way it was, but at the time it was just like, literally, like, if you know anyone who worships in any other way, if there's any other gods, if they're not like straight heterosexual, like everyone's going to hell.
Right.
Right. And it was just like, fuck, this sucks. You know what I mean? Like, that's not true.
That's a cold cup of coffee first period.
Yeah, that's not it. It's like, that's not true. It's like, so I always had the mindset of like, fuck that. You know what I mean? But what was funny about it was, the chapels every Wednesday, man, they were just so over the top and cheesy. And it's like, do you remember the power team?
No.
The power team was this like group of Christian bodybuilders. dude, they would come through and they would like rip phone books in half for Jesus, Dude, it was it was so amazing. It was so amazing, dude. And it just became this thing where, and then you had the power team ripping stuff in half. You had AC Green telling you not to fuck. You had all this different things happening. And it was just, it was just hilarious, dude. It was like that kind of era of religion. And even like, that was still kind of, you still had a, a, a good dose of like televangelism going on at sure. that time too. So it was definitely an experience, you know, yeah. and a good time to kind of like, you know, establish your own way of thinking. Yeah, you know, that was yeah. like, that was like the one thing that they probably didn't want me to get out of going to school there. But that's the one thing that I got that I'm eternally just thankful for, was, you know, learning to think, you know, with your own mind and to yeah. not just take things that people tell you, you know, especially heavy things like that. Like if you believe a certain way, or if you love a certain way, or if you identify a certain way, that you're not getting in to the after party. Yeah, you know what I mean? Right. Like that type of shit. I was just, you know, I was smart enough to be able to raise my finger to that way of thinking at an early age. And that, you know, obviously it goes hand in hand with punk rock and all that stuff. And just identifying as a free thinking human being. So, you know, so I, that's what I got out of high school, you know?
Well, I love that the power team helped somehow yeah. create the Bronx, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Like what, yeah, what a perfect scenario. Couldn't have been better.
Look them up. Look them up.
Yeah. I'm just imagining like the American Gladiators. It's just like too funny, man.
It's amazing.
I love it. Yo, Matt, we've been on for a while, man. I think that's good. I think we'll cool, bore brother. Everyone if we talk anymore. But yo, thanks so much for doing this. It was so much fun. I've been a huge fan of the Bronx from day one. Been rocking your hat, rocking your gear anywhere I can, because you're just one of the greatest bands to come out of America in a really fucking long time. And I appreciate everything you do, man.
Thank you, man. Right back at you. It's great talking to you. I appreciate you having me on.
Yo, pleasure. I'll hit you up soon, man. Thanks, Matt.
Thanks, Matt.
Producer Brad, you've been a hell of a producer
Dude,
lately.
Fucking Fletcher story is horrific.
Ooh. Oh my goodness.
And I found a picture that doesn't make it any better.
Dude, and now, like, now that the story's over, let me tell you the real, like, what I was doing during that story. I didn't see Fletcher on the other side of the stage. He was on the same side of the stage I was,
yeah.
and I went to the other side of the stage. Because, like, I kind of saw this playing out where I was like, oh, he's getting hyped.
You just got the vibe.
He's handling that bottle. Like,
right.
And I had, like, a casual relationship with him so far. So I'm like, I'm going to the other side just so I can just watch and not be dragged into yeah. whatever the fuck is going to happen. And I watched it all play out. It was insane, dude. And the part of the story that he didn't even tell is the fact that broken bottle went into the crowd. Like, literally got tossed into the crowd.
He slashed himself with the bottle, or was it an accident?
Did.
Oh, God.
No. He was doing it.
Right.
Multiple times. He just went for it, man.
Dude.
Went for it. And some other people involved with the situation told me what Matt alluded to, the fact that, like, it was difficult to get him to the hospital, and his right. behavior in the hospital was pretty insane. I had heard from some other people that was, like, very much true. And it took, like, a great negotiation to get him to even go get himself checked out. Right. Yeah, yeah. Oh,
Jesus.
But, you know.
Punk rock, like, baby.
So he's talking about, it's a true punk rocker. It's just, like, not some, like, skinny kid from the suburbs, you know. It's yeah. like a... That's just a punk rocker you can't put in a box, because no one's going to put him in that box, you know? I'm certainly not.
Fletcher's definitely a mythical beast.
Sure is, man. What a great band. What a great band. And then what a finish to that interview with the power team at school. Christian bodybuilders.
You can't wait to go look up the power team.
No, because that's so cool. I love, like, the things that people would do to try to spread the word of God. Like, how did that happen? You know, there's just three guys working out at Gold's Gym who are just like, yeah, yeah, like,
nice,
you know, I'm
cross.
A man of faith. Yeah, you guys look great. Like, what can we do that's positive?
Hey, is that
let's go bodybuild at Christian school.
Is that, you know, a tattoo of our Lord on your chest there?
Yeah, 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 yeah. It's just like, I love that shit. It's too funny. And honestly, it's one of the reasons I've always had a hard time buying into this stuff. Because I'm like, if this is like the ultimate word of God, like, why do we need, like, this much advertisement, you know? Like, if it was if it was like the true thing, like maybe
a lot of PR.
Maybe we wouldn't need the power team. I'm just saying,
a lot of PR behind Christianity.
I was hoping for a couple deep. He gave us like not only his top five Lakers, he gave us like the top five Lakers of all time.
Right.
I was hoping for some random deep cut, you know, like a Michael Cooper or something. But he went for the hits.
Yeah. Well, sometimes that's the hits are what it is, man. Right.
Yeah. It's probably this is why he's been a success in the music industry, Brad.
He knows the hits.
He knows the hits. You got to know the hits. But yeah, that was awesome having Matt on. I thought that was a super fun conversation.
Absolutely.
Quarantine talk is always a little bit of a bummer. What are you going to do?
No, it's comforting, I hope, for those other people out there going through the same thing. So
I think it's been really interesting talking to different people because it's like you can sort of see the people who are managing to find silver linings day to day, people who go the other way. And really, like, most of the people we talk to would probably give a different illusion of what's happening to them on a different day.
Yeah. No, that's really important. You
know, like you're literally catching people in some of the most vulnerable or strong or impassioned times of their life. It's a fucked up time.
It's the one thing that I'm really noticing personally is that you can really get into your own head, you know? I mean, I've questioned every part of my fucking existence during this thing. Like, But I do notice it, like, when I do get little kind of things, you know, whatever. It doesn't, like I said, that treehouse was for real, dude. That was like, that was awesome.
You needed a visceral, hands-on,
old-school dad old shit, school like, thing, fucking building a treehouse, man. Yeah.
And maybe even doing something where you start it and have the sense of completion and all that in the same day. That sounds great, man. I'd love to build something
But
like
I
that.
Would definitely, that's my, if I would have any advice, and I think it's why you see all these like posts. I mean, I can't believe how many people that I know who normally just are not the domestic types who are like, clean the whole house today, really proud of it, you know?
Right.
It's just like, just do something. You can do anything. Like, whether you make a craft, whether you fucking fix your, fix some furniture. That's another one. I go around the house fixing furniture, and that is very satisfying.
Totally. I mean, it's what Matt alluded to, right? It's like, you know, if you take away a musician's identity by not letting them play music, they're going to sit around going like, was I ever doing anything? Yeah. What kind of person I am? And I think that same thing applies to every single person who's home. Yeah. And I think the biggest highlight of this is how much of our identities have always been framed by our professions.
Right.
You know, and like literally, like when you die, the first thing in your fucking obituary is like, oh, 40 years working at the Ford plant.
Right.
Or, you know, like something like that. But nothing about like your spirit, the way you thought about things, the way you saw the world, like any of that stuff, the things that personally feel so important from the outside world is only validated through a profession. And so I think a lot of people are having that head scratcher moment where they're like, wait, is being a compliance officer the thing that I want to tell my
is
kids?
That my identity? Now, I am happy summer's here. I've definitely, my spirits are definitely raised by summertime, for sure.
We're in bed together, baby doll.
For real. Look at you. This definitely, I'm just waiting for somebody to walk in. This looks like phone sex, for sure.
Yeah. I might have some assistant. I'll make a text to bring in the hot oils in a minute. Yeah. But speaking of hot oils, I'm not wearing a shirt because I can't afford one. So, you know, I've been, we've been posting more on our Patreon. We put the Sean secret interview up there, funny outtakes. I learned how to write messages on there.
Yeah, nice job.
So, you know, now I'm going to start talking to people and having some fun on there. So, if anybody's got a couple extra shekels. Maybe check out our Patreon. What's the address?
Patreon.com/goingofftrack.
Okay, I should be able to remember that soon. And and we could take suggestions for other guests. Benny talking too much about things that are sad. Brad not talking enough. You know, come and hit us on that thing. I want
to
know.
There's links to all of that
going
on the website. You can link to the Patreon. You can link to like Twitter and Instagram, Facebook. Be our friends, man.
Yeah. But thanks to Matt for coming on and doing that. What they have some socials, right? The Bronx. Was it Bronxovision?
Bronxovision, Twitter and Instagram, yeah.
Yeah.
Check it out.
And check out them. Check out Mariachi. It's like a totally
different good, thing.
I really like it. I have no basis of reference. So that's where I'm like, I think this is good. But I don't listen to mariachi music, so I'm not quite sure.
I'll tell you,
but I know I enjoy it.
I'll tell you why it's good and why it's successful. And I kind of wanted to say this to him, but I didn't really have the chance. But it's because they're not trying, I don't think, besides the outfits. It's not like they're trying to mimic traditional mariachi. They're taking the rhythms, they're taking the sound, and they're doing their own thing to it. Like, you know, like...
Right.
I mean, even like just the way he sings and even the content of the songs is not necessarily like trying to, like, I'm trying to think of an example where people have done that and it's just been too like a ripoff. It's not a ripoff.
Like,
it's like,
here, I got one for you. It's Steven Tyler trying to rap.
Yeah, but that's,
maybe that,
that's
or horrible. Blondie trying to rap or Marky Ramon trying to rap. Right. You remember that era where everybody tried to fucking rap? That was bad.
Okay. Bad. But yeah, it's not, it's like, they're like saying like, this is great instrumentation. Let's do our own thing with it. I think that's why they don't get, you know, that's why there's, you can't really give them flack for it because they're not, you know, it's like just because they're using the instruments and the rhythms, it's, they're not trying to ape something else.
Yeah.
And I mean, if you get the respect of those Los Lobos guys, like, you're okay.
That's it. Yeah.
Because
I mean, even I wanted to not respect the Bronx when I first heard a band from Los Angeles was called the Bronx. Yeah. And you have all this hype and I'm like, you're not from the Bronx. You can't use that name. And then I hear them and I meet them and I'm like, oh, I love everything about this band. They could call themselves anything they want, you know?
Yeah.
You got to be good to get away with shit.
Nah, for real. For real.
Yeah.
And they are.
Yeah, they're going to ride high. I can't wait to see what those guys do next.
Yeah.
So, thanks for listening.
Yeah.
To Going Off Track.
And thanks, we got a couple new patrons that just came on over the weekend. Thanks to you guys. I don't have your names in front of me, but we love you.
And yes.
And, you know, if you want to hit us at Venmo, venmo.com/offtrack. Give us a tip if you're into it. Give us a good review on iTunes. And other than that, just listen to the show, man.
Very cool guest next week, too. I'm excited about it.
Oh, yeah.
We're going to have to wake up early in the morning to do it. We're going to do it. All right. Well, thanks, everyone. Thanks to Matt. And, yeah, we'll see you next week.
See you next week.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.